Talk given Saturday, 5th October, 1974. We have been meeting together now for several years, considering the nature of religion and the religious life in depth, considering various aspects of religious discipline which brings about that transformation of the mind and the heart, which releases the religiousness which lies in our being to the fullest extent and brings it to flower, which means that we at last are true human beings, the son of man, which is equivalent in actual fact to the son of God, because the word God stands for the conception which man himself has made for himself as the peak point of his aspiration and his possible development. Now let us not make the mistake of thinking, therefore, that man becomes God in the usual meaning of the word God, the transcendent, total, indescribable, immeasurable. Because man as man will always remain the measurable and therefore mortal. That is the difference. But the marvel is this, that it is through us human beings, man, through man, the mortal, that the immortal shows itself. The infinite functions freely and unrestrictedly through the finite. Now we have considered these matters to a great extent, and I feel that the time has come when we must be far more industrious with the living of the religious life. Consider carefully how the world situation is deteriorating rapidly. Now this deteriorating world situation can never be put right by any means or any efforts on the same plane as the problems and difficulties, the conflicts and the miseries of the world. All healing, all purification, all release into the fullness of its own destined being comes from a transcendent depth always. If there is no energy which can burst through from a transcendent dimension, then these dimensions must necessarily crack and break up and give place to the emergence of something new and wonderful, which Mother Nature will everlastingly bring forth. Silently she creates, silently she endures, and silently she reabsorbs us, whether come to fruition or whether we are just destroyed through our own folly. This is the marvel of Mother Nature. And if we observe that, we will understand, as few people in the world have ever understood, that this healing of the world comes out of the transcendent depths and the transcendent depths only. This is the real healing. What is the main implication of this? That our ordinary, worldly, self-oriented, self-centered outlook has to undergo a complete transmutation. It is not a question of replacing selfishness by unselfishness. You and I, as ordinary mortals, cannot ever do that sort of thing, for the simple reason that our unselfishness is merely an opposite to our selfishness, and the two opposites will everlastingly be in conflict because we are aware day and night only in terms of duality, not in terms of a transcendent unitary wholeness. This is the great point. Therefore, what has to undergo change? Our mode of awareness of existence as a whole. In other words, the one total reality has so to fill us, we have to become so unresisting that it will fill us. And our self-centered attitude undergoes this complete change, and the eternal truth, God, Brahman, the infinite, the immeasurable, use what term you like, functions freely through us. And it is that which brings about the change which has gone beyond the point of rebounding back into ordinary conflicting worldliness. Now, what is the key? What holds the key position in this? Is it not the psyche of man? We are an animal species as an ordinary psychophysical organism. We are an animal species. Animals also have psyche. They have feelings and so forth. But we are extraordinarily different from all other animal species. We can look within ourselves. We can contemplate time and space and existence in a manner that no animal can possibly do. And because of this, because of the activity of this withinness interacting with the without, we can introduce into the universal process an element which no animal, no plant, and certainly no stone can introduce. So, this psyche of ours really holds the key. It is the psyche which is the crucible of transformation for the individual. What is the most powerful influence then, changing the psyche? Is it an intellectually conceived ideal or goal or system of development or purification? No, it is not. And this is the mistake that so many sincere religious-minded people have made throughout the centuries. The essential power that brings about this transformation of the psyche is the transformation of the mode of awareness of existence. And this mode of awareness undergoes transformation if we insist upon observing one special aspect of our daily life. Mindfulness. We have to be awake, really mindful of everything. Now, this do not mix this up with becoming self-aware, as so many people say. Become fully self-aware. Most of us, perhaps all mankind, is unfortunately too much self-aware. Instead of being unself-aware, which means, therefore, aware in terms of the whole, the totality, the one total reality, which is the holy, the numinous. The thing which comes right into our being insofar as we function in terms of a state of unknowing rather than of knowing. This cloud of unknowing, the title of a marvelous work in Christian mysticism, is like the Dharma Megha of Buddhism. The cloud of Dharma. Megha is a cloud. The cloud of Dharma. A cloud. That means something which hardly offers any resistance to anything, which in itself has no definite form and shape apart from a general form and shape, perhaps, which will show, therefore, what the trend of our life and our spiritual growth and development has, without tying it down to anything particular. The moment you tie it down to something very definite, it will please the intellect and it will destroy the spirit. This is what we have to bear in mind. That where the spiritual life, where the religious life is concerned, we must be free of too much cohesion, because then we come right down into the state of immobility. The freedom of the mind, the unconditioned freedom of the mind, cannot be realized under those conditions. So now, this mindfulness, we can never come to the end of learning the nature of mindfulness, because the whole of life has to be one long mindfulness. Whether we are religious or not, whether we are worldly, whether we are wicked or saintly or whatever we are mindful of the things that compel our attention or to which our attention naturally flows. Isn't that the fact? That's the fact of our life. On all planes. Very well. If we are to be human, that means also if we are to be wise and loving, in the true, the transcendent sense of those terms. If we are to be that, then we have to be mindful in the way which brings to flower our religiousness. This religiousness which is the sense within us of complete communion with the totality, with God, with the universe. The state of communion. This is the thing that we have to wake up to. And intellect by itself, mere knowledge, even the knowledge of a philosophical genius, is more an obstruction rather than a help. If philosophy, science, and art are just the handmaids of religiousness, then philosophy, science, and art are the very means, the very avenues, the channels of communion opened up before us in anything and everything in our lives. But mindfulness. Now, a mindfulness which has to be applied to world conditions. Now, be very careful here. This does not mean that we meddle with the techniques and the practices of economists and politicians and goodness knows what not. We are all mess makers in the world. And we are mess makers because we enter into these activities at their own level. But we have to enter into their activities in a transcendent manner. Now, this is why I talked about the psyche holding the key to the whole situation. Consider, what is it that raises up are actual political, economic, social and other conditions and events and all the rest of it. What is it that does it? There are three main factors at play. One is the natural resources and the condition of the land itself, the country itself. We can't do anything about that, or at least, or at any rate, extremely little. I can't do anything about an earthquake or a flood. If it takes place, well, it takes place, and that's that. And whatever takes place on a big scale, on a universal scale, is non-selective. It engulfs everyone alike. Angel and devil, sinner and saint, stupid and wise, we are all engulfed by whatsoever takes place on the universal scale. You know, the classic instance which I gave, if a sinner and a saint are deeply engaged in their argument whether God exists or not, and they step over the 2,000-foot precipice, the answer is the same at the bottom of the precipice. Gravity does not select. This fellow was a saint, he must live and continue, and that fellow was a sinner. Both suffer. Anything that happens on the large scale, and the larger the scale, the more this holds true. It engulfs everything that comes within it. There is no point in asking whether it is just or unjust. That's just an absurd question. It doesn't apply in the context. So we have to leave that out. Well, now, natural conditions are one. The weather, the resources of the within the soil and so forth. We can, of course, be foolish enough, cut down forests and spoil the weather and produce deserts. We can, up to a certain point, exercise a little control over nature, but not much. The second factor consists of human institutions, our political, economic, social institutions, our cultural institutions, and all the life which we go through as the express result of the activity of people's minds and feelings and so on. Our institutions. But our institutions arise in relationship to the natural background, the soil on which we are born. Very much related to that. However, there they are, our institutions. Now we can exercise some sort of control over our institutions. This year particularly, we know what little control we have over our institutions. But there we are. Where they are concerned, we have a little more power. The third factor is the most pliable factor of all. That is ourselves. Human nature. We have this false statement that human nature does not change. It is a completely absurd statement. It undergoes change and growth as nothing else undergoes change and growth. Only the time span involved is so great that in our ordinary 70, 80 or 100 years of life, we cannot see this change. And what do we mean by change in this context? We mean particularly the transformation which goes on in the mind and the heart of man, of each one of us. So you see, what you or I desire, think about, work for, comes into being in interaction with our institutions and with the natural condition of the land on which in which we live. These are the factors at play. Now the wise man is he who, realizing that it is out of this transcendent depth that the healing of our difficulties and troubles has to come, will therefore be concerned with the change in the psyche. Now here we must not make the mistake of thinking in personalistic terms. the concept of an immortal soul or an entity, a being that persists through time and space, identifiable, recognizable forever and ever. This, unfortunately, has given a wrong conception of psyche and mind. We talk of my psyche, my mind. Now, these phrases, my psyche, my mind, have become so ingrained in because of our daily usage of these terms, that only for convenience sake, I shall speak in terms of my psyche or my mind. There is no such thing as my mind in any case. Mind is a universal, unknown, immeasurable energy, if you like, which, interacting with this particular body, this particular organism, manifests certain mental phenomena. Because of the structure of the brain, the ductus glands, and so forth. And they are different for every single human being. And therefore, the differences in the mental manifestations. There is a blueprint, so to say, by virtue of nature's activity for each and every one of us. And this universal energy mind shows a different mental life and history for each single individual. Just as out of universal matter, all our bodies come. We are all made up of the same electrons, protons, and all the rest of it. And they are absolutely alike. There's not the slightest difference between any one proton here or at the other end of the 2000th galaxy in the distance. They are identically the same. So just as this comes out of what we may conveniently call universal matter, a particular, unique, individual pattern out of universal matter, so too the psyche of each individual is a particular pattern of universal mind interacting with universal matter. Now this we must understand very clearly. Because mind is an energy which we cannot grapple with at its universal level. We can only deal with it insofar as it functions through us as our mental states, our feelings, and so on. So, whatever thoughts and feelings I go through affect the psychical atmosphere, so to say, which is a universal thing like the atmosphere of the earth, the air. And whatsoever is floating through the psychical atmosphere affects me all the time. If I am unawake to this fact, if I am not mindful, watchful, alert all the time, then this psychical atmosphere can just pick me up like that and involve me in whatsoever is either good or evil in the dualistic sense within our ordinary ambivalent psychical sphere of action. But we have to become free of this tyranny of the ambivalence of the psyche. And it is only mindfulness that sets us free there. Note carefully, therefore, that as and when the psychical atmosphere is so disturbing that it puts one, say, into a state of violence or depression or whatever it may be that takes place inside oneself, we must not fight against it. We must not try to suppress it or overcome it. You can never overcome evil in the sense of annihilate it or defeat it forever and ever. You can only transform that expression of psychical energy into a pure expression. and I cannot transform it merely by my intellect deciding how, what sort of shape it will take. The transformation takes place simply because I remain so quiet and still and watchful that something transcendent takes over and affects the transformation. This is how the transmutation takes place. It does not take place by fighting against evil, neither fight against it nor give way to it. Resist not evil, said Jesus. Neither indulge in this, whatever it may be, nor fight against it. This is our individual task, our special task. And I can never overemphasize the importance of understanding this. Just stay still. If you get caught in a monsoon shower in India, don't open your umbrella. It's useless. Because it is so fierce that the drops of water rebound back upon you and you are wet from top to toe. Just go with the shower. Enjoy the rain and keep cool. And that's all there is to it. Now, psychically too, when the storms come, just keep calm and keep cool. Go through with it, stay with it, because your psyche, my psyche as such, is unkillable. It will not be hurt so long as I don't resist. Sympathy for suffering, yes, intense sympathy for suffering, which means I suffer with it. But it is not the kind of suffering which is the suffering of an incurable disease which is inevitably going to kill you. This is the point. You are unconquerable. Therefore, you don't need to attempt to conquer. But if you stay calm and peaceful and quiet inside, just going through with it, then all that is happening from the outside coming upon you gets transformed into something rich and strange and beautiful. You absorb it within your own being. And do realize that here you wield a power which transcendence itself wields. A power for infinite containment, infinite absorption, and through that of transmutation. And you don't do the transmutation. It's transcendence which does the transmutation. This, to me, seems religiousness in action. Now, as this transmutation takes place through your psyche, you being the unresisting medium for it to happen, it is this which changes your own mode of awareness of existence, and it affects the whole psychical atmosphere. And we have no idea how that psychical atmosphere affects the environment. We don't see the good results. We don't need to see the good results. Because our definition of good is such a poor definition. We just don't know what is good. It's downright conceit. In a very childlike way, we know this is good and that is bad, yes. But apart from that, let us never have the conceit that I know what is good. Especially the way people say that I know what is good for you. Now, therefore, with this watchfulness, night and day, there comes the point when you are mindful in your sleep. You will find it stated in the Upanishads You will find the Buddha saying this. When Jesus said, when you pray, pray to your Father in heaven in secret, which is your most secret condition? When you're in slumber, especially in deep dreamless slumber, in that state, the most terrible of men is harmless. He is not harming the world in which he lives. You see? In that harmless condition, you are in your most secret condition. Utterly hidden, unknown to the eyes of flesh, but completely seen by the sleepless, immortal eyes of transcendence. So, when you pray to your Father in heaven, pray in secret. And this prayer means the supreme mindfulness, because prayer in its deep sense is identical with samadhi, with meditation. The deep contemplative prayer is the same thing. And that is always in secret. And in the Upanishads, they use the very term Gudha Supti, the secret sleep, the secret yoga sleep, as they call it, where you are in the state of unmani or amanaska, that means in the mindless state. Now do not mistake the meaning of the word mindless in this context. It doesn't mean that one has become an idiot. Far from it. But it means that mind as we know it and use it has at last stopped interfering with both God and nature. We use mind all the time self-oriented for our purposes, to gain our selfish ends, to ward off things which we don't like, and so forth. To spin out silly little plans and ideas about, oh, this thing called pleasure, and thereby ensure the destruction of our true happiness. There is nothing which destroys true happiness so wonderfully perfectly as the pursuit of pleasure does. So, this mindless state means that what we call mind is now in this state of utter crystalline purity, transparence, perfection, unresisting transcendence. And this is the meaning of the mindless state as spoken of, not only in the Upanishads, but in all the mysticisms of the world. They knew that secret simply because they realized that silence, they experienced it. Now you might ask, how do they know that they have experienced it? Because what we call knowledge necessitates the knowing subject and the known object, which is different from the knowing subject. They know it in retrospect. Whatsoever experience you go through, whatsoever stimulus comes upon you, registers itself upon the organism. And nature has so made the organism that one can recall, if one has trained one's faculties, one can recall that which one went through in a transcendent condition. And therefore, the statement is made in terms of words and thought, that such and such was the case. But it must always be remembered that in the retrospective view, in the expression in speech and thought, there is a loss of dimensions, and therefore the expression is always faulty. The proof that it is always faulty lies in the history of the world. Have human beings quarreled more fiercely over anything so much as over religious differences. You see? And the religious differences are in terms of words, ideas, fixed beliefs. And all of them imply the clinging to this monkey ego. Otherwise, I would be offended. I know better than somebody else. My views, my religion, my mode of life is superior to everybody else's. I am the chosen one. You see, it's a pathetic folly from which mankind has suffered. So now, with mindfulness, the psyche remaining steady and calm in the midst of storm, this process of transmutation goes on. So our task, if we want to participate in the life of the world in the right way, consists not in interfering with the affairs of the world, deliberately interfering, moved by our petty little intellects, but of remaining peaceful in this manner and letting transcendence affect the world's psyche. This is the supreme way. It will involve other action also. That is inevitable. That's the nature of life. That's the nature of things. But if there is this power to remain poised and therefore rightly dispassionate, which means dispassionate with complete sympathy and understanding for what is going on, then whatsoever physical action we perform will be the least harmful and the most helpful. It is important that groups like ours should look into this very quietly, very seriously. Not solemnly, but seriously. Don't feel it as a weight upon one's psychical and spiritual shoulders. No. You and I are not Atlas carrying the world, and never will be, and never should be. Don't feel it as a weight. If a thing doesn't take place, and you see suffering, and you feel, oh, I could have done this, that, and the other to have alleviated it, keep calm. Yes, that opportunity was missed. But supposing I had taken the opportunity, it would take a super magnifying glass to be able to see the good that one did for the world. It is our conceit. Be careful of that. Let go, all right. It's easier to be in the also-rans than those who come first, second, third. And those who strive to come first, second, third are worldly of the worldly. Don't forget. Nothing to do with religiousness, in which sphere there is no such thing as comparison. Just one last word then in this connection. Every day in our lives, we have to go out into the world, we have to get up in the morning. All the daily activities, watch the reactions that emanate from here to each and every stimulus. Watch the reactions. Do we watch them? how easily we forget to watch them. If we don't watch them, then we get caught up in the maelstrom and we make it worse. But if we are caught up in the maelstrom and are watchful in that condition, then that maelstrom will not destroy, will not harm so much as it would have done otherwise. Meditate upon the passage of Odysseus between Scylla and Charybdis. It's a wonderfully instructive thing. And you will see deep truths which bear upon the nature of mindfulness. So watch this very carefully. This is very important. As specific retrospective activity, usually the night is the best time when one goes to sleep. Review the day. Look back into it, step by step. You'll probably fall asleep before you've 5 minutes have gone, but you'll sleep very soundly if you do. But look back through the day and see when one was forgetful. Forgetfulness is the great devil in us. It is not the waters of Lethe of which we have to drink. If we are wise, if we want to live the religious life, it's the waters of the stream of memory. Because if memory fades, then the perfecting remains undone. That is why memory is so important. Right memory. Now, I'd suggest that before we meet again, if you feel like it, during the night, I mean, when you go to bed, just go back in memory. Don't criticize. Don't approve. Keep a little box, you know, and put a penny into the box as your fine if you either criticize or approve. Just go back and look. And the power of looking and being mindful, you will find that you will grow the faculty of continuing that in your sleep too. That is one of the ways of developing this faculty. In your sleep too, it will be there. And if there are problems which have been perplexing to oneself personally during the day, time and again, the answer will be there next morning. Because this mindfulness will have enabled you to see dispassionately the truth of the thing as it is. So, try this during the coming fortnight. Note down what happens. And if anything interesting emerges, well, we can consider it together if you like.